Good afternoon. Welcome to the House Transportation Committee, calling to order at 1:01 in the PM. Today is Thursday, January 27th of 2022. Members present are Representative McCabe, Representative Kronk, Representative McKay, Representative Drummond, Vice Chair Hannon, and myself. Let the record show we have a quorum to conduct business. Assisting us today is our recording secretary, Leah Frazier, and our LIO moderator, Nate Williams. And will be joining us throughout session during our committee meetings to ensure we have accurate minutes, clear audio and video, and smooth telephonic testimony. Are there any questions before we get going with today's hearing? All right. Today's meeting is another presentation from DOT Deputy Commissioner Rob Carpenter and Director of Program Development James Marks about Alaska's Statewide Transportation Improvement Program, the STIP, and the role of stakeholders and local projects. Get called up and get onto that list that we learned about earlier this week as well. With the passage of the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, the STIP will be an important means for the identification and advancement of critical infrastructure needs across the state. Deputy Commissioner Carpenter, Director Marks, please come on up to the hot table, put yourselves on the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rob Carpenter, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And I will probably sit back down and let James run this show. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. James Marks, Director of Program Development and Statewide Planning, for the record. So good afternoon, and thank you all again for the opportunity to share the DOT and PF public process for identifying, evaluating, and selecting projects that go into the Statewide Transportation Improvement Program. So I was told that I'm going to try to add a little bit more energy this time. I was told I have a very calming voice, which is not helpful when we're talking about something as very procedural as this. I'm kind of taking a deeper dive. So I welcome questions and appreciate, again, the opportunity. This is going to be a really important time this next year and the coming years. So I'm going to take a little bit of time to talk about what the division is, program development, statewide planning. That adds some context because there's a lot of kind of layers that add on to how we eventually get to a call for projects. I'm going to provide kind of a roadmap for, we talked about apportionments, those federal apportionments, and how those translate into our state regulations and eventually make their way into a project selection process. I'm going to walk through some of our programs, the National Highway System Community Transportation Plan, and then we'll start to go through kind of the procedural piece, which is that call for projects. So to start off, I wanted to talk about the mission statement for the division. Mission statement says to optimize the state investment in transportation and meet federal requirements through effective planning and programming. This is important for several reasons, but notably the second piece, the transportation planning process is not optional. It is required. Not only is it required, but it is the first step in identifying, selecting, and getting a project into the STIP. We have a diverse team of planning professionals all over the state that will be working with your constituency to identify and assist in packaging the products into the federal requirements. So we talked about the STIP. Moving on to the next slide. The STIP is just one of many of family of plans. It exists in a hierarchy of plans, the top of the umbrella being the long-range transportation plan. And this has a 20-year planning horizon and sets the stage for identifying trends and scenarios and kind of is the feeder system for many of our other plans. Our funding and financing plan is in development. We don't currently have one. And I think this is where some of the presentation on the STIP fell short, is we don't do a great job of explaining it. It's very confusing sometimes. What is the STIP and what is reality? The STIP is a plan. It's not a budget. And I think a lot of people look at it because there's dollars and schedules in there that the STIP, it gives issues our intent for what is going to happen. That what actually happens very often changes sometimes from day to day. Things happen during project development. Things slip or move forward. So it's kind of this constant juggling situation that creates confusion when what's happening out on the street is different than what we say is in this plan. So trying to get that updated and telling our story better funding and financing plan will help to kind of start to put some pencil to paper in terms of what reality is, as well as identifying what the difference is between gaps and needs. Our area plans are the next level down from our long-range transportation plan. The idea here is that the state is so big and so diverse, and there's so many different socioeconomic needs, environmental needs, that we need to break it down into regions and areas. And we've done that. And there's regional plans that are developed that kind of start to spell out what these things look like. For a particular region, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region, for example, had its area plan updated in 2018. We're wrapping up our Northwest Arctic Area Transportation Plan right now.
Just one quick second. Just wanted to recognize that we had Representative Stute show up, arrive at 1:06 p.m. And Representative Hannon, do you have a question, or are you just thinking with your hand?
Sorry.
No problem. On that note, I would love to jump in then and take my chance for a question. Last year, the Department of Transportation Budget Subcommittee introduced some intent language, and I asked about this on Tuesday as well, for an acronym that I can't remember, but we call it an MPO Light, the planning for the unincorporated areas or places that haven't reached the population or density for their own MPO. And one of those was just started, or that pilot program was up in the Northwest Arctic, correct?
We've had conversations with the Northwest Arctic leadership team, correct, Mr. Chair? I believe there's a number of steps to be coming, and that the name is similar to an MPO, but it's a regional transportation planning organization. So it's not specific to one municipality. It covers the needs and areas of a region. I believe that they're in the process of passing a referendum that, yes, they do want to proceed down that path, but there's a number of steps in becoming an RTPO.
Great. And then will you be going into what that process will look like for getting their input into the into what the STIP would be and going forward with that local planning and how that might be different than an MPO?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you. Representative Stutes has a question.
No question. I just would like to apologize to the committee and to the presenter for being tardy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly. No problem. Please proceed.
Great. Thank you. One of the other plans that's important is our statewide active transportation plan. This is the plan that covers all of our active transportation. So that's bike, ped, trails, curbs, and things like that. This is a plan that's important for a number of reasons, and we've actually recently received national recognition. We've been invited to present our active transportation plan in the Federal Highway Administration's. There's a lot that goes into that, from mapping out all of our facilities, creating an inventory, and helping to prioritize all those active transportation needs. Our Transportation Asset Management Plan, or the TAMP, is one of the driving forces behind our asset management. So that is a predictive model that looks out and says, this is what your pavement and your bridge and the condition of your assets is going to look like over the next 10 years. And this is what your investment level should be to maintain certain levels. And wrapping up, one of the many plans is our state strategic highway safety plan. This plan is the foundation for much of the work in making our transportation facilities and users of those facilities safer. The plan has significant public involvement from stakeholders across the state to include the Alaska court system, Anchorage Police Department, Alaska truckers, the DMV, public safety, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, and many, many more. It's about 45 agencies across the state to help participate in making this. We are at the outset of starting our new strategic highway safety plan. And this will be important, and I'll touch on each one of these, because as we start to get into these programs and our call for projects, particularly some of the mandatory programs, they are driven from a lot of these plans.
Thank you very much. Representative Hannon has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Marks, have we gotten to the point that we now include active transportation planning in all of our transportation plans so that it doesn't have to be an after effect of, are we producing a bike path, a pedestrian corridor? And I understand that there's certainly some, you know, divided highways may have federal restrictions if you can't have a pedestrian path down the median. But I live here in Juneau. I represent Haines and Skagway, and we're sort of retrofitting many of those with trying to provide active transportation corridors. Are they still siloed from each other, or have we, is that now integrated to all the transportation planning, that that's a consideration, or does it, is it always a standalone, separate after the fact?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon. Absolutely, it's integrated, not only at the state level, but also at the federal level. You'll remember the new bridge program that has come out, with the largest investment, dedicated investment in bridges. Part of that guidance says that if a facility can legally have a pedestrian facility and it's cost effective, that it has to have a pedestrian facility. So it does work its way. We do have a separate standalone program just for pedestrian facilities, but we do also, to the extent practicable and cost effectiveness, we'll try to work it into our other plans. Yes.
Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. I'm interested to know, inside of all the alphabet soup here, if there's a priority system and where you put things, I guess. I mean, in two of these now, you mentioned curbs, and a couple of them you mentioned pavement and assets and all of that. So I assume there's, you know, the funding plan probably has where the priorities for what you do probably resides. And can you talk a little bit about it? And maybe you're going to get to it. I didn't look too far forward, but can you talk a little bit about how that works and what the priorities are and that sort of thing?
Yes, absolutely. Through the chair, Representative McCabe. Yes, there is a priority. Those priorities can vary by program because each program has certain objectives. In general, we could say that we're going to take care of what is required and mandatory first. After that, we're looking at what does it take to maintain our assets. And then from there up, it kind of goes into modernization and expansion. And the amounts for each one of those might vary depending on what the current policy is. If the policy that we receive says we want to maintain and modernize our system, then that would change, you know, potentially how funding gets distributed among things. And I will talk more about that also.
Follow up. So maybe get a little bit more granular. Two things you said, what is required, or mm-hmm. So who makes the requirement, and how does it, how do you determine, you know, there has to be some sort of a matrix, I would think. You know, you need a road to go from point A to point B and be passable, you know, 12 months out of the year for the people that live in point B. Who determines that road, where, what priority it is, and how do you determine that? Is there certain specifics, you know, is it a goat trail or is it a two-car road, or how does that work?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative McCabe. To your first point on terms of priorities, most of our priorities, well, I'll talk about, and that's why I thought it was important also to include a scan of our federal and our state regulations, because that kind of spells out where some of that gets defined. Most of the plans you see on this list are federal requirements. These are not state requirements. We usually do have a state regulation in some instances spelled out to mirror the federal requirement. The statewide transportation improvement program, for example, is in our regulations, but it's also listed out federally. And I will talk about kind of that Project A versus Project B, kind of that evaluation of alternatives also later, if that's all right.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Marks, you had mentioned to Representative Hannon her question that a lot of these, and especially the overall concept of them working together, is coordinated at the state transportation planning level and the federal planning level. With her examples of Haines and Skagway, how can we incorporate a local level into that planning discussion?
Chair Hopkins, perhaps you could elaborate.
If we're looking at where the roads need to go, the improvements need to go, where a bike path needs to go, as she was looking, talking about, how do we make sure that a local interest and local knowledge and local planning efforts are incorporated into that state and federal planning as well for all of these when they're working together?
Oh, sir, certainly. Chair Hopkins and Vice Chair Hannon. So we have one of the slides I'm going to be getting to is going to talk through the organization of program development. And I'm sure probably everyone's kind of aware that we have broken the state up into regions. that those regions have been further broken down into planning areas. And each one of those planning areas, we've assigned area planners to. So one of the important pieces to this whole and making this work, especially for constituents and local governments, is identifying who that area planner is and getting connected with them. That's the person that's going to be helping you to translate all of these needs and figuring out how do we prioritize what our needs are and how do we make them fit into the federal requirements.
So it's, they're working with an individual who theoretically would be in charge of planning for that municipality or that small
area, yeah.
Assuming they have some person who's charged with planning.
Correct.
As one of the many things that probably those small communities, local governments have as other duties as assigned. Representative Hannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Marks. So I'm going to get a very specific example. So the Haines Highway, which has been a multi-year major federal highway improvement project, and out of Haines away, there's a cluster of people who all live in Mosquito Lake, and only as that expansion of the highway has gone on have they realized they've lost all their, what they had thought was their bike right-of-ways. They're all gone. The highway's been expanded to accommodate bigger trucks and transport, but it's constrained by mountains and water, and as a result, what they lost was the ability in that cluster of, they consider themselves a neighborhood, their access between themselves to the new improved highway. And what they foresee is now our kids are going to be riding the bike as the big trucks go by. And instead of there being a shoulder that we've gotten used to using, now there's inches and it's not a shoulder. But, you know, it's one of those projects. I've only been an elected official 3 years. And it was like the planning for that was done probably a decade ago. So is there a way for a community, once you see on the ground what this means for you, to change anything? I mean, it's, I've sort of gone, oh, it's a federal highway project. I don't think we can ever change this to help. You're going to just know the schedule of trucks coming by when the ferry comes in and an hour later get the kids off the road, which is not a very good plan for a community to operate. Is there a way for communities when they finally see on the ground? You know, an engineer has the ability to sort of forecast and be able to think of that. What's this really look like when it comes to fruition? But I think for many communities, that's not something that they understand until the pavement's dug up and the lanes have been expanded. And everybody in Haines wanted that, right? We wanted that road improved, but at the detriment of the neighborhood feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon, I probably couldn't speak to that one in particular. I think in general, yes, we always welcome public input. One of the challenges we face, especially with these really long, expansive projects, is once we dedicate federal money, we have an obligation to either finish it or we're in a payback situation where all of that money has to go back. So there is a decision there, and I can certainly get you some more specifics on that one. But there's always room for discussion in terms of, does this just not make sense anymore? And if not, what is the path toward, what does that off-ramp look like for a project?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Certainly.
Thank you, Ms. Fox.
Mm-hmm. Please proceed.
So I'm not going to spend too much time here. I just wanted to put a couple faces to some names as you or your constituents start to get more involved in the DOT process. My deputy director, Adam Moser, there to the right, oversees many of the statewide functions, including the LRTP, transit, the statewide bike, ped planning, transportation data, and statewide MPO coordination. Our highway safety office coordinator is Tammy Kramer, over there to the right. She oversees the development and execution of the statewide strategic highway safety plan. To the right is Jill Melcher. One area that we've been putting a lot of attention to over the last 2 years is our data and making our data more authoritative and quality and improving our use of data. We put together an approach for improving our data and ultimately making a better and more informed decisions. So in doing so, we've reorganized and we've created a strategic planning and data section. And Jill Melcher has graciously stepped in to act in acting position there. The three individuals you see there in the middle, Ms. Judy Chapman is our Fairbanks Field Office Planning Chief. Todd Van Hove is our Anchorage Field Office Planning Chief, and Marie Heidemann is our Juneau Field Office Planning Chief. And those will be the individuals who will be overseeing all of the area planners and corridor planners and things that you'll be working with in this endeavor.
Mr. Marks, before we move on, you were talking about how you have regional planners broken up, and I'm guessing that's the three there in the middle. And then there you talked about breaking it up into even smaller areas within that. Can you point to me where they would be or if they are on this sheet?
They are not on this sheet, Chair Hopkins. They are on the next. We have a planning map that I'm going to show you. So this gives you a sense of what that map looks like. The red line breaks up our regions with our northern, central, and south coast regions. And we further divided the areas into planning areas, and those are represented by colors. Those colors have area planners assigned to them, and we've got their phone numbers on here for you so you can get a hold of them directly. In some instances, we do have vacancies. We do have changes in staff. You can always reach out to the planning chief assigned to that region if you're unable to get a hold of your area planner. And when all else fails, I do have a phone as well.
Representative Stutes.
How long has the Marine Highway Planner been vacant?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, that position has gone through a number of changes. We've recently gotten approval to reopen that position, and that position, I believe, has actually just posted, and we'll be closing in about 3 weeks.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
So I'm going to do a quick scan of regulations. So one of the approaches we thought of when talking about this presentation is, how would we talk with a city planner or someone who's trying to get up to speed on what do they need to do, what do they need to know going into this process? So these are some of the fundamental planning regulations that we kind of operate by and how we work with political subdivisions. 05170 defines how we classify projects, and it puts it into four broad categories. That's the National Highway System, the Alaska Highway System, Community Transportation Program, and the Trails and Recreational Access for Alaskans Program. 175 defines how the department will identify and evaluate our needs. Evaluation criteria are listed out in there, and for both the CTP and TRAC. And they include things like the effect on the economy, resource access, health and quality of life, safety, mobility, the burden to M&O, as well as whatever financial contributions the sponsor might be willing to provide, and public support, typically in the form of a referendum. The Project Evaluation Board is also defined in that regulation and comprises a deputy commissioner, the director of statewide design and engineering services, myself, the director of program development, and our three regional directors. I'm very fortunate to have a long line in my supervisory chain, the commissioner, deputy commissioner, who are all very, have a very local and municipal focus. And so we recognize that this is all agency employees. So one of the things we're trying to evaluate is how do we expand this net and do it in a way that's meaningful, but also not unwieldy. So those are some of the conversations we're having right now about what does the composition of that board look like.
Mr. Marks, is that safe to say that you're working on new regulations then?
That would be correct.
Great. Do you have any time frame for when that would be?
Well, if I may make an adjustment, we've had the conversations about our regulations. We're not actively working on it. I don't have a timeline. One of the challenges with our regulations is that the last time that these were, there was a significant public involvement and maybe not call it contentious, but it was a lot of back and forth because it was what precisely gets included in these things, how are our projects going to be evaluated. So it took a very long time. It was a heavy lift. And at this point, it was is it a now or do we evaluate? So we're having the discussions, but there's not an update in process.
Thank you for that. When was the last time they were updated?
Chair Hopkins, I don't have that information for you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Hopkins. So the Project Evaluation Board, that's set in statute, the composition and who makes up the board?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, it's set in regulation.
Regulations. So, okay. And you're currently talking about that regulation, and what's the thought? What's the vision? Are we going to maybe include a member of the public or something?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe. Yeah, we've gone through scenarios on what that looks like. Is it someone from the legislature? Is it someone from one of these large activist groups like the Alaska Municipal League or something similar? You know, we don't know. The challenge is how do you include some but not others? Equal representation. You know, once we kind of put our thoughts together more, we'd probably be ready to share more, but we don't have anything.
Thank you. Please proceed.
05.200 lists out what our mandatory projects are. I'll talk about those in more detail and what those look like. Those are also sometimes referred to as recurring and required programs. So over the next couple slides, I'm going to do a bit of translation. So how do we get from all of the apportionments, the federal apportionments that we described, and again, those are statutory apportionments, and how do we get from there to our state regulations, which are the National Highway System, AHS, CTP, and so on. So I'm actually going to work backwards at our regulations because that's going to be what's going to kind of shape our call for projects, and we'll show you where these funding sources kind of go within these programs here. Starting with our National Highway System and Alaska Highway System, of note, these two programs are not subject to 175, and 175, again, is what defined project criteria and the Project Evaluation Board. In the past, these two programs were strictly data-driven, and the state selected projects for these systems. I've mentioned it, I think, a couple times, but we've got an administration commissioner that is very inclusive. So that's another one of these things that we're looking at. We do have our asset management, things that we just know we need to fix or maintain, and those are still things that we will keep made data-driven. But one of the things that we've started pursuing in our effort to become to better use data and be more strategic is implementing what's called performance-based planning and programming. What that does is that starts to inject more data into how you're evaluating your projects. The first step in that process was the creation of how we stratify our projects, and that's where you see this diagram over here to the right that we've kind of modeled after Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where we're going to take care of what we have to at the base first. Recurring and required, in order to get federal funding, we need to do these things. After that, we need to maintain what we have, and that's our state of good repair. After that, we'll improve what we have. This is modernization, so these are going to be things like safety improvements, where we're looking at intersections, looking at passing lanes, adding pedestrian facilities. And then it's going up to the kind of top tier, which is that expansion or making things new. And this could be anything from capacity expansion to adding new facilities. So one of the benefits, there's several benefits with this model and kind of stratifying, is one of the challenges we've had in the past is that it's difficult for projects of a certain type to compete against other projects. A state of good repair project, for example, does not score as well as, say, a nice modernization project that has a lot of safety features and pedestrian facilities. So doing this helps us to evaluate projects of similar nature and also to be more intentional about how we invest. And this is where I was kind of describing earlier, where the word that we receive that the policy is, we want to maintain and preserve, then that is how we will also look at investing in the National Highway System and Alaska Highway System.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Hopkins. So Maslow would be rolling over in his grave to know that his hierarchy of needs was part of a transportation system discussion. But I'm interested to know the NHS and the AHS. So I'm a little confused, and there's a question mark on this on the previous slide with the arrow pointing over. Are the NHS and AHS improvements, are those on the STIP list? They have their own list, or are they funded maybe from one of the other sources that we talked about very early in your presentation?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative McCabe. Yep, great question. Everything that you see here is going to be on the STIP. Some of these, and I'll call those out, will be as a program instead of individual projects. In this case, where we have NHS and AHS, these will be individual projects listed out in the STIP.
Thank you.
On that same note, where do airports fit into that program and individual plan, individual projects, and then on overall planning?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for that question. The airport improvement plan is actually a separate plan outside of the STIP, and that's where all of our rural airport improvements would be found.
Thank you. Go for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So along those lines, is that covered in this, or is there a separate presentation on rural airports?
Through the chair, Representative Stoops, there would be a separate presentation probably from our statewide aviation team on the AIP.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in that if we get a chance, if they don't already have it planned.
I don't think we do. We'll put it on the agenda. We'll see what we can figure out. Certainly. Make a note, Mr. Hardenbrook. Please proceed.
Once we have our stratification, the next step is developing project evaluation criteria. This gives you an example. One of the things that we're pursuing as a goal for these new criteria is that we want them to be predictive. It's not just what does the facility look like now, but what is it going to look like? What does that improvement look like so that we can actually measure where we're going to and where we're from? And that will help us to get an idea of what the benefit cost is. How much are we actually getting for that project versus, say, another project? This gives you a sense of one of those criteria sets. This is specific to the National Highway System State of Good Repair. So just that yellow block and just the NHS, where half the score for State of Good Repair project is going to be coming from the predictive pavement condition improvement. And these are some of the other factors that kind of work into there. We would have separate criteria for modernization and expansion. The National Highway System is funded by NHPP, and the Alaska Highway System's chief funding source is the Surface Transportation Block Grant.
Representative Stoops.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when you're determining these and you're looking at areas that need repair or whatever it is, if a state road is affected, mm-hmm. but the area that needs the maintenance or whatever you want to call it is adjacent to the easement of the state or on the other side of it. Do you follow up? Do you work with whoever that easement is? And I'm speaking specifically of Kodiak and out by the Russian River. And there's a bridge. It's a state bridge, which floods every single year. And I just had a conversation with DOT and Kodiak, and their response was, well, where we'd have to fix it isn't on the state land. It's on the other side of our easement. Well, who owns it? Coast Guard. Well, do you work with the Coast Guard? Do you say, hey, look, we collectively have a problem. Is that something that you do?
Through the chair, Representative Stoops, absolutely. There's significant interagency coordination on projects like this, whether it's the Coast Guard or DEC or environmental, when we're talking about waterways and other things. I don't know that one in particular, but I can certainly get back to you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Rep. Hanna?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marks, I just want to make sure I understand that State of Good Repair category would be, it's not in good repair now, and we're simply bringing it back. So it's the rutted asphalt. We're not changing the dimensions. We're not making it a higher speed access. But that's not considered normal maintenance. We need, because that would be the reoccurring. I mean, if it's at home, you're going to do this as normal. You don't wait and then go, well, we got to bring it back up. But that category is, it's now below good repair, and we're bringing it back to state of good repair, but no improvements. No bigger culverts. We're not diverting the water. We're just getting the ruts out of the pavement.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hannon, yeah, that's an excellent point, and you're absolutely correct. To a point, I would add the caveat. So this is largely a preservation. We're not going to be adding any of those things that you talked about. We're not adding. We're not widening. We're not straightening alignments. So you're not going to find any safety. You'll notice there's no safety criteria in here. This is about preserving what we have. So maybe I've answered.
Yeah, and just one more follow-up on that. So from the average driver's perspective, it sometimes seems like we let it get to a pretty poor state before we repair it. And I'm wondering if that's the nature of we don't have enough money to do all the regular maintenance so it doesn't, or is this criteria in dealing with national highway systems sort of require it to get to your popping tires or your causing, you know, there's some measurement matrix that it's got to get bad enough before you can bring it back to a state of repair. Because I think all of us hear from constituents that go, it's in really bad shape. How come? And then you go, well, we're going to repair it next year, but it's got to get bad first.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Hannon. Yes. Excellent point. And that's, I mentioned it briefly, but the transportation asset management plan, that's where we're kind of laying out. And this is not just when it's gotten to a certain state. So we have pavement engineers and a pavement management system. And it actually has predictive modeling, so we can tell what the future state of pavement will be at any given point, based off of models. And these are models that are based off of region, because every region pavement deteriorates at different rates. The goal between that asset management plan, or the TAMP, and this, as well as the other program that I'll talk about in a moment, is our preservation and management program. The goal is to take care of it and preserve it through smaller but more frequent treatments like chip seals and things out there before it gets to a point where we start getting rutting and cracking and some of those more things where we have to do a full reconstruction. So that asset management plan does spit out a predictive investment level. Like, we need to invest at least $130 million per year to maintain our facilities and keep them at a certain level.
Thank you.
On that note, is $130 million the number that we're using theoretically year to year? And I assume that's of GF?
Chair Hopkins, no. Okay. That's federal, and it's hypothetical. The M&O component is a separate piece, and that's when we're starting to see potholes and things, and those things need to fix. There's a whole maintenance, separate operating budget for that.
Representative Drummond?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My district is lucky to have Minnesota Drive in it, which gets upwards of 50,000 vehicles a day. In 2009, with American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, Minnesota was repaved roughly from, I want to say, maybe 13th Avenue downtown, where it's L Street, then it becomes Minnesota Drive and goes downhill almost to Northern Lights. It's not very far, but that pavement, I don't know what kind of magical pavement was put down that year, but that was in great shape until maybe a year or so ago. I have never seen a pavement that gets that much use last for so long. And prior to that, it was a freaking goat trail, you know, in terms of potholes. It was awful to drive on. There was nowhere to put your tires that you didn't hit a pothole. So I'm really curious to know what kind of pavement was used on that project that allowed it to weather so well.
Yeah.
And why isn't it being used elsewhere, I think would be my next question, because the longevity of that particular paving project continues to amaze me.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, yeah, thank you for those kind words, and I'll also pass them along to our statewide design and engineering services chief, and she would be the one that would be able to best answer that, and I'll certainly follow up with you on
appreciate
that.
Appreciate that.
Yeah,
maybe that's what we should try on questions. Maybe that's what we should try on Goldstream Road. Representative McCabe.
So this, thanks, Chair Hopkins. This kind of dovetails with the conversation right now. I've done extensive driving in Europe, Germany especially. Their roads are always fabulous compared to ours. And I'm wondering if we, since we changed to the, what is it, the CWCG, instead of the lowest bidder bidding, and if we are going to have see a sort of an uptick in the way the roads are. I understand that materials are a big part of it, and materials that are on hand in Alaska are oftentimes substandard, depending on what borrow pit you're getting the gravel from for the pavement and that sort of thing. I get that, but is, and this might be the wrong place to ask it, but is that type of project management going to result in bigger and better built, longer lasting roads where you have a manager that starts out and does the whole thing and instead of the lowest bidder for everything?
Yeah, great question. Through the chair, Representative McCabe. Again, I think that's a question for an engineer, so I can absolutely follow up with my statewide design and engineering services and get you an answer for that.
Thanks.
I wanted to ask a question that follows up on Representative Sue's question about the easements and how it is and what the local knowledge of what is needed there. Looking at the project evaluation criteria, cost benefits, project delivery, all that stuff is good. Is this required? Is that criteria specific in the National Highway System laws that they have that we must work with? And then is the AHS criteria the same? And is that in regulations and available to change as you go forward to incorporate more local planning efforts so mayors or assemblies can put in that or service areas or whatever it would be?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Mr. Chair. It's a very good question. These are criteria are not in federal statute or regulation, and they're not in state regulation. So we're looking at ways of trying to do it using more data and data that will help us select the right project, but there's no federal rule.
Excellent. I was happy to hear you mention earlier that the current commissioner in place is very active in the planning and the coordination with local entities, and we certainly have that up in Fairbanks with our FAST planning, our Fairbanks Area Surface Transportation. And as this is sort of just up to the blowing of the wind direction, how you guys project evaluation criteria and what that is, it's not written down anywhere. I urge you strongly to work with the commissioner to make sure that there's more local planning involved in that process and not just a mayor or a single individual, but what is, you know, non-motorized vehicle planning look like in that area? What are the needs of walkers? What are the needs of transit? What are the needs of local car drivers as well? Thank you. Please proceed.
So next up are our CTP and TRAC programs. These two programs follow similar processes and feel mostly the same to those involved that are going to be putting their projects forward, except that they have different, they're looking at different projects and they have different requirements. The criteria is slightly different from each one. This is the language that you're going to find if you're to do a regulation scan. The community transportation program is for surface transportation facilities of local or regional significance that are owned by the state or its political subdivisions that are not included in the NHS or in the AHS. So there's a couple of important takeaways here. The projects serve a local need, not just locally owned. This means that the state can submit and very often will submit projects as well as others. Political subdivisions are also the only ones that can submit projects. So when it comes to advocacy groups, they and other interested constituents, they would like a project, they need to work through their local political subdivision, city, municipality to get work with DOT to get those on the books.
Are you going to be going into the E-STIP? You mentioned it at the last trend plan. Are you going to be touching on this at all, on that project at all later in this presentation?
That is not currently in this presentation.
Okay. Thank you.
track projects. This program is somewhat antiquated because these regulations are older, and I will say that this is one of the things that we struggle with is every time a transportation bill comes out, how do we make these new federal rules fit within our regulations? And this kind of gets again to the point of we've been talking about what does a regulations update look like? How do we get there? We're not there yet just because of how big of a lift that is. In general, we've still tried to meet the intent of this through the federal program that's known as the Transportation Alternatives Program, and that is mostly looking at bike, pedestrian, sidewalks, limited recreational trail, where there is a small tranche of funding that comes for rec trails, and that gets transferred over to DNR, and they do hold a recreational trails evaluation board. They have a long-range plan that I think they're updating now called the SCORP that is looking at, you know, kind of all these recreational facilities and working with the public to figure out, you know, it's tourism, it's recreation for Alaskans and things like that. The primary funding source for both of these programs is STBG. And I mentioned TAP, Transportation Alternatives, because TAP is actually a set aside from STBG, and it's significantly increased this year. There's a lot of focus on pedestrian facilities with this administration. So that set aside is going to be 10% of STBG, so roughly 17, possibly 0.6 million. We have not received those formulas and that's those set asides yet. Right now, we've just received the bulk apportionments that we went through the other day. So that is going to be change the way that funding may be distributed to some of these active transportation facilities.
Thank you very much. Representative McCabe.
Thank you, Chair Hopkins. So the TAP money, the set aside, are we just going to try to spend it on trails that we don't necessarily need? Or are we going to identify where people want trails and put trails there? In other words, I see a bunch of money coming at us, and I see us building trails and those sorts of things where nobody will use them. So I'm wondering, if there is no use for it, if we can't find any use for the TAP money in a region, is there a way to send it to another region or to another program? Or are we going to have to build a useless trail to nowhere, just to use the money. I'm a fan of some university. I read the story years ago where they built the university, they put the sidewalks in, or they didn't put the sidewalks in. They waited for the people's paths between buildings to show up, and then when there was a path between dorm A and the science building and the way the people walked, then they put a sidewalk there. So they knew, you know, it was a smart way to do it. Identify human behavior before you put. So the same thing here. Are we just going to build a trail that no one's going to use, or are we going to? Sorry, that was a long-winded kind of a comment, but.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe. Great question. The answer to that is no. We're not going to. We do have options for transferring money from one apportionment to another. To your point on, are we just going to build it just because we have the money? One of the federal rules is that it is a very public process. Like we can't even submit. While the CTP above, we can submit our own projects. The TAP, we cannot. So that is a strictly public nomination process where we kind of source those projects.
Thanks.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Do you know if any of that money that TAPs under the surface transportation block grants can be used to complete what is a desperately needed pedestrian bicycle corridor along the Seward Highway so that we can finally complete from Potter Marsh to Portage, where, of course, we have a lot of vehicle deaths, and it's just sort of a miracle and a mystery to me that we don't have more pedestrian deaths. There are a few corners and points where there are always people. and I grew up on that corridor of road, and it's been there and a problem for over 50 years. But I don't know if that's too much, and you wouldn't know because it needs to be somebody working that. But what I've, you know, when it's been raised before, it's sort of like there's money to do the next 3 miles, and then there's another 3 miles, and you go, there's a 100-mile corridor that is actively used, and we need to have that fixed. I don't know if any of that money can be used for it.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes, absolutely. Either the TAP or the STBG could. It is also on the national highway systems. That would probably be our preferred if it's, you know, falls into eligibilities. And I also know that there is a lot of attention on the sewer to highway right now. To your point, yes, transportation alternatives funding could potentially be used there.
Okay. I'm planting that seed for Mr. Carpenter to take back to find out because, you know, all over the state, anyone who drives that, you go, there are pedestrians who are just begging to be killed. So let's prevent it.
Certainly a magnanimous question considering that's not in the Southeast region. So, but it is a statewide concern. You said the track money goes to DNR, you said, right? And then they have a very public process there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So track is not a federal program. That is one of our state programs. There is no track funding. The funding source for this, there is a small piece that comes in called recreational trails, and that piece does get transferred, yes.
Right. Where was the $17 million that you were talking about earlier?
So the STBG, there's okay. Two little asterisks here, and says that STBG has set-asides. So one of those set-asides is the TAP program.
Would that be available to be used on something like the long trail that was proposed last year from Fairbanks to Seward?
Mr. Chair, I would have to look into that one. There's a little few more eligibilities, fewer eligibilities, I should say, less focused on recreational purposes in the TAP program.
Gotcha.
So it's usually more connected to connecting communities and things.
Thank you. Please proceed.
So I did say I would touch briefly on these mandatory programs. When we talked about composition of the STIP, we talked about, I described how there were some state programs, and then there was the capital improvement program projects. This is where you're going to see what are mandatory. These are most of these required federally. The Highway Safety Improvement Program, the National Highways Freight Program, so some of these should look familiar. Congestion Mitigation and Air Quality, our Preservation and Maintenance Program. All of these programs either have a data-driven federal requirement or have a policy, in the case of our Preservation and Maintenance, that dictates how we go about doing that. So that is a data-driven program, but that's a state data-driven program, not federal. One of these programs require a plan, such as our National Highways Freight Program, and the new PROTECT program will require a resiliency plan. So you'll see here at the bottom that when we talk about all of those different apportionments, you have NHPP, which comprises over half of the funding that comes to us. STBG comprises about 25% to 27%. All of the other programs you're going to find mostly in these mandatory programs and projects. We will on occasion have an individual project in the STIP, but many of these you're going to see a program and not individual projects.
Thank you. And is that looking at the CMAQ one there? Congestion mitigation and air quality must be in a defined air quality area. Are there other defined air quality areas within Alaska that have impact outside of the Fairbanks area for our PM2.5 concerns? And what might some of those air quality area be?
Certainly, Chair Hopkins, we do have both maintenance areas and non-attainment areas, and both of those qualify. Anchorage, Eagle River, areas of Juneau in the valley have dust, so I believe that might be PM10. So there's a few areas. Usually it's going to be your urban areas that are going to be in the non-attainment or maintenance areas.
Thank you.
Go for it. I'm curious. Thank you, Chair Hopkins. I'm curious where you find the guy with the biggest slash pile to put the sensors downwind of for the.
He's in North Pole.
No, I think he's in the valley, actually.
Any other questions on this slide?
I've seen him across the water.
There you go. Please proceed.
So I walked you through a series of cycles, and I had a conversation with Representative McCabe, and it looked like a series of wheels, and that's true. It is kind of a cyclical process. Today, I'm going to be focusing in, now that we've kind of gone through some of the kind of requirements that sets the stage, what that process looks like. So this is really just that center section, mostly also really focusing in on each one of those pieces where there's a public involvement component. So I'm kind of really getting into the weeds and defining what does that public involvement look like and how do we go about doing it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Marks, can you say that again about getting the public involved in this process?
Right. So at each one of these stages where you see this little yellow group icon, those are areas that the public can get involved in this, in the call for projects process. So I'm going to spend the next couple of slides going through in detail what that looks like for each step.
Thank you.
Slide 13 gives you a high-level view of what a call for projects effort looks like. In general, it takes around 15 to 16 months from the time that we start to the time that we end. There are components that can be expedited, but those are also usually the ones that the public does not want to move faster because they need time to source their projects and put together their packages. There's four major steps that we've broken out into specific actions. And I'm going to cover each major step on subsequent slides, and those kind of comprise the pre-public notice and program prep, which is about a month and a half worth of work, the public notice of intent to apply, which is about 5.5 months. The call for projects is another six months, and the project evaluation board, the board itself is only 2 days, but the build-up and the retrospect after is about 2 months worth of work. So the first major step is the pre-public notice and program prep. We do this through notifications. We'll plan to hold a statewide meeting available virtually as well. Our communication paths will seem repetitive. You'll see on each one of these sides, what does that communication look like? But all generally follow the same channels. We do post on the online public notice website. You'll see the website listed there. Individuals can go and actually subscribe to Just Transportation public notices so they can get an email or a notification every time we put a notice out. We also post on GovDelivery. This is the website there, and you can go through. There are a lot of options on GovDelivery. Anyone wanting to subscribe to receive those notifications will want to find the section that says STIP and subscribe to those three notifications. We also have statewide planning and regional mailing lists that go out. At this point, DOT, when we're having this meeting, you know, one of the things I guess I want to point out is I mentioned that at the end of the cycle, we do a retrospective where we're kind of what went well, what didn't go well. This did not used to exist, this kind of preparatory phase. One of the things that we heard from communities is that when we do our notice of intent to apply, there is not enough time for them to find their projects and get things together. And notice of intent to apply is the first most important step to be eligible throughout the rest of the process. So there's going to be some things that we don't know and we won't be able to communicate when we do this pre-public notice, such as our criteria. At this point, we'll be developing criteria. But we can tell you a timeline. We can do a walkthrough of our regulations. We can talk about when we are expecting to do a notice of intent to apply, introduce them to planners and things like that. So it's really that kind of preparatory phase, what the program is, what the general eligibilities are, and a look back and say, this is the last cycle, and these are the types of projects that did well, and these are the reasons why. And that, we hope, will help to kind of give people a little bit of lead time to start to look and identify projects in their areas.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, Chair Hopkins, and sorry for all the questions. It's just, I just don't know. So I'm curious. Seems to me that a lot of these, by the time they get to the public process, the public input process, the project is already committed to by DOT. So where's the germination? Is there any point in the public process where DOT would look at all the public notices and all the public discussion and say, public doesn't really want this, we're not going to do it? Or is that prior to all of this, when in sort of the germination phase or something like that? So it seems like to me from these slides, I see that the public process enters in after the idea is already out there and that we're actually going to do it.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, this is the first step. We certainly do collect needs, whether those, needs, I think before when we had the larger slide, there was like a green box that said we're the source of all of our needs. And some of that comes from DOT and condition or performance data when we're seeing congestion build up or a certain amount of accidents. But we also put public needs in there also. When we're talking about this is an opportunity, particularly with community transportation program and the transportation alternatives, for anything additional. So this project has not been started yet. It is going to be developed in joint with the sponsor. We're going to develop what the scope looks like for a particular project and start to work through some of the details on how much is it, how big is it, and then it kind of goes through that review process.
So follow up, you mentioned sponsor. And I notice in this slide 12, in the call for projects area, there's no little group of yellow people in there. So I'm wondering how a project gets germinated. Where's the little yellow people that say, hey, we need a bike trail on, or that sort of thing. And then you mentioned sponsor as well. So seems to me like these projects get germinated somewhere in some bureaucrat's office somewhere, and the public has no real, we need this here kind of thing, or they have no real way to shut it down because it's already sponsored and it's already moving forward by someone in the big, huge bureaucracy that I see stacking up here, and the public has no real way to shut it down. I mean, I think it's great. The public input's awesome. I've never once seen public input shut down a project or change a project that the DOT already has planned.
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we can certainly put together a more detailed response for you. We do, I can't speak for the past, but I can tell you that going forward, you've got a lot of people in this administration and this agency that are very interested in local needs and the public's needs. And I think what you're going to see in some of this is trying to change some paradigms and put more public into the process, even things that were historically just DOT, and trying to figure out how do we do that, balancing the needs of the state and maintaining our facilities and taking care of our economy and things like that nature. But also, to the extent possible, there is the question, of how do you balance that with just the sheer volume and trying. So part of that is connecting and getting the right requirements together. That's why I think you're going to see in the regulations it says political subdivisions. But you're right, it is a series of bureaucracies that individuals would have to go to eventually get things on here. And how do we make that shift? And that's a big ask.
Thanks.
To work through.
Yep. I'm going to hold you to that.
Thank you.
Representative Hannon, do you have a question?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for the record, the idea of a pedestrian right-of-way on the Seward Highway was around in the 70s when my mom would not allow me with my friends to bicycle from Anchorage to Clam Gulch, where we were all headed. I had to ride with the family in the car. And now I realize how insane it was for my friends and cousins to be bicycling that when there was absolutely no shoulder. My question, under statewide meeting on slide 14, it's one of your first bullet point is retrospective of previous cycles' outcomes. And I don't, what's a cycle? So is that all 15 months on the decision grid on page 13? Is it change in length of time with every project? Or is there a set time frame where a cycle? In Department of Fish and Game, and they talk about it, there's a specified cycle of review and meetings.
Right.
That they're not tied to projects, they're tied to seasons and consumption, so I am sure it's very different, but what does that mean?
Sure. So this going back to slide 12, shows you what that cycle looks like. This does represent about a two-year effort. Our regulations actually do spell out, both for CTP and TRAC, it has to be done at least every 3 years. We also recognize that if we're doing it every 3 years and project delivery time is somewhere between 4 to 8 years, it can be take some time. So we're trying to look at how do we expedite some of these things and get into more routine cyclical cadence. So looking at 2 years, but anything beyond that is, you saw the 15-month timeline. It's a lot of people being mobilized to get all this done.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Just sort of a response to Representative McCabe's questions about sometimes projects might not be in the best planning or best interest of the local ideas. You know, we've had in Fairbanks, projects have been canceled from public input. So much, one I remember was an extension of the Steese Highway going through Creamer Field in Fairbanks was being looked at but was stopped. But at the same time, another project, the Chena Hot Springs Roundabouts, had nearly unanimous opposition from the public, but what did move forward? Do you know what criteria allows one to go forward and one to be stopped in this process when so much of the difference is public input?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would probably have to get back with you on that. Yeah, and get some specifics.
Certainly. That would be just another reason that we need to input more active local interest and local input from the call for projects, as Representative McCabe put in. I think that's something we might give the commissioner a heads up. We will certainly be hounding him on for confirmation hearings.
If you don't mind, Chair Hopkins, a little editorializing. So I see $3.5 billion for highway funding over the next 5 years, $225 million for bridges. I also know that we have a number of bridges that aren't even being used that we built. One happens to be in Representative Cronk's district. And I just, and then there's, you know, the whole bridge to nowhere. And I see a lot of funding coming in, and I see a lot of bureaucracy, and I don't want to build a bunch of stuff that we don't need if we can use the money elsewhere, such as the Marine Highway System or airport improvements or somewhere else that the public really wants and really needs. It could be the trails along the Seward Highway. I mean, there's a ton of things that we need, and there's so many things that we have built or half built, such as Port McKenzie and the rail spur, that we could maybe put the money to if we get creative or if we can find a way to do that inside this huge amount of bureaucracy. So that's what I'm concerned about, and I think Chair Hopkins has the same concerns as the public. And I appreciate what you said, but for the most part, in the last however many years the DOT's been around, the public has been ignored. And my constituents are not happy with that. So, sorry. Thanks for the opportunity to put that out there.
I think we all have enough anecdotes from back home of where people were not happy with this process that I think we're in unison in this committee for sure. Please proceed to the next slide. I believe we're on slide 15.
Correct. So moving on to the next phase is the public notice of intent to apply. There's a couple things that happen during this phase. We're going to release our draft criteria that we've been working on at this point. That usually takes about a month and a half to 2 months to get feedback and update the criteria. I will just note that the criteria, again, for both CTP and TRAC are defined in regulation, but the data that's used, how we calculate it, how we weight it, what's important is not. So those are the things that we're going to be looking for in these updates as we're trying to figure out priorities. And so soliciting public input there is going to be very important. Running simultaneously will be our call for projects phase one, which is the notice of intent to apply. And this is that first step to making sure that you get your project into the pipeline. When we do our formal call for projects in the next major step, you have to have issued your notice of intent to apply. Sponsors are not required at this point to have a fully developed project. You just need to know what, have an idea of what your project is, what the area is, what you think the general scope of work is going to be. We'll put out, you know, templates or whatever, forms, and be working, we'll be holding, at this point, we'll be having regional planning meetings. So we'll issue those out through online public notice or gov delivery, and that's where you'll be seeing planning chiefs and area planners getting out and holding public meetings to walk through what this notice of intent to apply looks like. They'll be going through, you know, everything I just said. At this point, we're not talking about a detailed scope, schedules, and estimates, engineering numbers. That'll be the next phase. At this point, it's just figuring out what the world of the projects looks like.
Please proceed.
Step three is our call for projects. At this point, we have our final project evaluation criteria, and that gets published with any revisions. One of the things that we're going to be starting to do is also showing a change log so that we can see the difference between what we started with and what happens at the end. So we can kind of not, it's demonstrating how we're listening to the public and making changes based on that. We'll have our list from the notice of intent to apply. Project sponsors are given counsel by planning staff on their best course of action. We may advise that a project may not work, score well, and that it doesn't, but that does not preclude them from submitting. Project sponsors can still submit, even if we think it's not going to score well. That's their prerogative, but we'll kind of give them the advice based off of the situation. Again, we'll be using gov delivery and public notices and mail list. At this point, we'll be providing the templates and the forms for the call for projects and what that nomination package looks like. This is also going to be the phase where we will be getting into detailed scopes, schedules, engineers' estimates. There's going to be, you know, potentially geotechnical work that has to be looking at things and slopes, traffic counts, safety statistics, M&O burden and costs, how much a municipality or political subdivision is willing to put in terms of financial contributions to the project. The step is the longest, usually taking about 5 to 6 months.
Can you give me an example of what a sponsor would be? Maybe a few examples. Is it John Blow, Derek Joe Blow down the street? Is it an actual entity? Can you give me a couple examples?
Absolutely. So our regulations stipulate that it can be this in the CTP program, it can be the state or any of its political subdivisions. So the city of Fairbanks or the city of Bethel or municipalities, things like that. Those would be the individuals that we'd be working with. The state, so when we talk about individual members of the public or groups of the public, with respect to the CTP, because the state can submit, you can work with our area planners. So that's what our area planners are there for, to solicit and get input and feedback. And in those instances, if we go through and look at the scope and say, yes, this looks like a need, this would do well, then the state can submit or sponsor that project. In the event that it is a local or municipal or rural community, that can come through those political channels as well.
Thank you. That makes a little bit more sense. Please proceed.
Once we've completed the call for projects and all packages are received, we move into our last step, the project evaluation board. This is a 1 to 2 day meeting, usually in Juneau, but can be held across the state. We're considering rotating where this might be held. We public notice the meeting with the typical call, and it is also available through a virtual option with call-in, and with everybody moving to telecommuting, we've got new tools available to us, so we can also do these on Microsoft Teams or other platforms, potentially. Our regulations stipulate that evaluators shall score each project using the criteria that's available to them. That would not be any different, that once the criteria is public noticed in its final form, it will not change. All projects are scored and ranked based on score. At this point, we have a ranked list, but these list is not programmed in the STIP. Other factors come to bear on the programming of these projects beyond just score. That includes things like, is there room in the STIP, fiscal constraint? What does the project development schedule look like? Depending on how big or how large or how much time it takes, it might need to be programmed either further out in the 10-year plan. There's also best interest findings that could come to bear. Notes from the meeting are made available, and we offer opportunities to comment on the process, as I mentioned during that retrospective, trying to improve, either build in more time, make staff more available, are all things that are well within our control.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I think I missed something at the top of the page. What is OPN? I'm on Gov Delivery, for example, for the Anchorage International Airport, because a couple of my community councils are impacted by the airport, so it's good to have that those kinds of notifications. But what's an OPN?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Drummond, OPN is the online public notice. On one of the previous slides, there's a link there, and you can go and subscribe to DOTs.
You have to go looking for that. While Gov Delivery delivers to you, you have to go looking for the online.
You can subscribe to it, and it'll send you notifications.
Just like Gov Delivery.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would add that even if you are already subscribed to Gov Delivery, there's a lot of different listservs on Gov Delivery. You're going to want to make sure that you're on the DOT and the STIP specifically to get those notifications.
Please proceed.
So wrapping up the presentation today, I wanted to again reemphasize the importance of relationships and connections throughout this process. The department is expecting to go into a series of call for projects in the coming months and years. And the big takeaway that I've hoped in this presentation are to be prepared, subscribe to our online public notice and Gov Delivery, and find out who your area planner is. Connect with them. That will be the person that will be walking you through the federal and state rules, regulations, and processes, and will give you your project the best chance of success in getting funded.
So that answers one of my exact questions that I had written down to get back to at the end. Where are we at in this cycle?
Mr. Chair. That is an excellent question. At this point, we're kind of even in the pre-planning. We're still trying to digest what all of this new infrastructure bill means, and we're not entirely clear on what the net effect is. So there's larger policy-level decisions going to be made and how things are coming in. Representative McCabe mentioned the bridge program, and that is about $45 million per year. In the past, the state would receive somewhere to the tune of $30 to $40 million in additional funding for bridge work based off of the condition of our bridges. That was during the appropriations act, so the budget that they pass every year. If that doesn't happen, if some of these other things, these other funding pieces don't happen, the level of funding. So we're still waiting on the appropriations act to see how some of this stuff is going to play out.
So we're at the pre-planning for this whole cycle this time right now, because there's going to be so much difference. So if we as transportation members emailed back home, our road service areas, if they count as political entities, our local planners, our municipalities, our different neighborhood organizations, to reach out and say,
start coming up with projects. They're going to be coming out in the next couple months with a with intent to apply process. That would be well timed.
Mr. Chair, I would caution to wait for that initial first pre-public notice. I don't want one of the things I want to avoid is having people spend a lot of time prepare things if that call does get pushed out for any number of reasons. So I would probably wait for that first notice from the department.
Even though there's a decent amount of prep work and information and cost estimates and design estimates and things that you guys want to see before it's a real project, do you think they should wait for that initial email?
Again, Mr. Chair, I would say that having a list of priorities at this point would be good. There isn't going to be a lot of funding put into developing scope schedules and estimates before kind of that initial triaging step during the notice of intent to apply. But can communities get prepared and start talking with stakeholders in their areas to define, get a prioritized list? Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
But putting DOT, engineering resources into doing scope schedules and estimates probably would be a little early at this point.
Thank you. I would love to then, if we don't have any final questions, because we're a little bit ahead of time here, delve into the E-STIP that you talked about at the last presentation. That it looked like they had a lot of dots for the projects are, so people could say, this is something I feel about that project or identify something about it. Is that an opportunity for people to put in new projects as well, and somewhere that we could direct a smaller entity like a road service area that doesn't go through the metropolitan area in Fairbanks or Kenai that doesn't have one, and say, look at this new program that they're going to be releasing soon, and this is an opportunity for you to be your own sponsor on a project. Is that you are nodding in affirmation?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. Well, I would caveat that with whether it exists in that platform or another platform, we are trying to get things to be map-based, visual, where somebody can click on a point, identify a facility, and say, this is the need for that facility. We would like for it to exist all in one platform. That certainly makes the management and transparency of the process easier. But we're at the very early stages of the E-STIP. So I would also mention one of the things I didn't talk about before is that we're doing the implementation of E-STIP in phases. So when I mentioned, that going live in September or August, that's going to be the kind of commercial off-the-shelf package. We're going to have some input. Customization is going to be kind of further down the road. So some of these things, like where we might do a public comment portal or a neat comment, public needs list for soliciting, might be a future improvement later.
Thank you. Well, with that, I think we can release Mr. Marks from his week of being on the hot seat here. Thank you very much. I appreciate your input and willingness to dialogue with us here on the committee. Our next meeting will be Tuesday, February 1st, although we might need to change the time from the 1 p.m., so we'll be reaching out to you just to double-check on time changes. That hopefully will be an overview and the DOT and public facilities operations overview from 2021. The following Thursday, the 3rd, we'll be discussing DOT's response to the major winter storms that impacted nearly every region of the state. So we'll probably have a lot more community anecdotes to come at you with. Please come prepared to discuss with all those ideas and offer your suggestions on behalf of yourselves and if there's anything from your communities that they saw that could be tweaked or changed. Without any additional questions or comments, we'll go ahead and adjourn at 2:25 today. Thank you much, everybody.